Hello, IRIS listeners. Welcome to Hour 3 of the Des Moines Register. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. I'll begin this hour with the obituaries. Robert Van Blaricum, known as Bob, of Des Moines, age 64, passed away on January 27th at Iowa Methodist Critical Care. Bob was born May 22nd, 1956, in Des Moines, to Charles and Dolores Van Blaricum. He was a very honest and loyal gentleman. He was a jack of all trades and could fix anything. Bob lived life to the fullest and wasn't afraid to try new things. Bob is survived by his loving wife, Zeta, daughters, Tanda Van Blaricum and Miranda Van Blaricum, 6 grandchildren, 5 great-grandchildren, siblings, Charles, Peggy Hecaden, spouse Stoney, and Tom, spouse Kim, and sister-in-law, Linda. He was preceded in death by his parents and brother Doug. Visitation will be held Sunday, January 31st from 2 to 4 p.m. at Hamilton Southtown Funeral Home, 5400 Southwest 9th Street. Funeral service will be held on Monday, February 1st at 10 a.m., also at the funeral home. For those guests unable to attend, the service will be live streamed on the Hamilton's website. Masks are required and social distancing is encouraged. Memorial contributions can be made directed to the John Stoddard Cancer Center or the Animal Rescue League of Iowa in loving memory of Bob. Condolences may be expressed at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Nada Lee Snyder Cooper, age 89, of Cumming, joined her Heavenly Father on January 25th. Services to be held Saturday, January 30th at Fellowship Community Church, 224 North Avenue, Norwalk, at 10 a.m. Due to COVID, there will be no refreshments or gathering following the services. Interment will be held privately at a later date. Nada was born December 29, 1931, to Fern Prescott and Lee Fitz of Yale, Iowa. She married Robert Wayne Snyder of Perry on June 5, 1953, and was married for 42 years. She was a friend to many and a stranger to none. She was a homemaker and mother of 5 children on the south side of Des Moines. As the children started to leave home, she became a phone operator for Northwestern Bell Telephone Company, where she retired after 22 years of service. Nada is survived by daughters Tessa Hildebrand, spouse Mike of Winterset, Lisa Brill, spouse Wayne of Des Moines, Brenda Weatherly, spouse Dale of Cumming, and son Robert Snyder II, spouse Joan of Des Moines. She has 14 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her parents, 2 sisters, Nellie Baugh and Linda Kemble, both of Panora, husband Robert and second husband Tom Cooper of Des Moines, and daughter Julie Crow of Des Moines. Amos E. Purcell Sr., 91, passed away on January 22nd in Des Moines. Memorial services will be at 2 p.m. Tuesday, February 2nd at Isles Grandview Park Chapel. Services will be live streamed from Amos's obit page at www.islescares.com starting at 1:45 p.m. Tuesday. Private urn burial will be at Highland Memory Gardens. Amos was born in Des Moines on January 30, 1929, to parents Amos and Mabel Purcell. He graduated from Lincoln High School in June of 1947 and enlisted in the Army Air Corps. He was honorably discharged in 1950 with the rank of corporal and later re-enlisted in 1952 to the Air Force. Amos married Viola Schneider of Carter Lake, Iowa, and had 2 sons, Ronald and Terry, of this marriage. He was later married to Annalise Todd of Wiesbaden, Germany. They have 4 sons, Andrew, David, Dennis, Amos Jr., and adopted Connie and Matthias. Upon completion of his last tour of duty in Vietnam, Amos received the Bronze Star and retired from the U.S. Air Force in September of 1969 as a Master Sergeant with over 20 years of service. He was later employed at BMS and Iowa Farm Bureau, retiring after 10 years. He enjoyed bowling and worked at Fairlanes for 5 years. Amos and Annalise liked to travel. He watched football and loved spending time with his family and grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, Amos and Mabel, wife Annalise in 2000 after 36 years of marriage, 3 sons, Ronald, Andrew, and Terry, and sister Marie. Amos is survived by his children, Connie Oberender, spouse Mike, Matthias Purcell, David Purcell, Dennis Purcell, spouse Kathy, and Amos E. Purcell, Jr., spouse Jacqueline, 15 grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be directed to the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital. Nicholas Samuel Romano, age 91, died on January 22nd at Iowa Methodist Hospital in Des Moines. Nick's death was the result of an earlier fall on January 14th. Nick was born on May 25th, 1929, and was a lifelong resident of the south side of Des Moines. After graduating from Dowling High School, Nick worked for Meredith Publishing Company. While employed at Meredith, Nick received his draft notification and honorably served our country in Korea as an infantryman in the United States Army. Upon his return from Korea, Nick served the city of Des Moines as a firefighter for 40 years, retiring at the rank of district chief. Nick also worked as a stagehand, was an active member of the stage local number 67, and was a fourth degree member of the Knights of Columbus. Nick is survived by his wife, Clara Lee Sassatelli Romano, the love of his life for 66 years, 4 sons, Joseph, spouse Janie, Nicholas, spouse Kate, Mark, spouse Pam, and John, spouse Lisa, 10 grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, sister Teresa, spouse Francis Schluter, and sister-in-law Jenny Stefani. Nick was preceded in death by his parents, Joseph and Julia, brothers-in-law Nello Stefani and Ferdinand Sassatelli, and sister-in-law Joanne Sassatelli. Visitation will be held Friday, January 29th from 8:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. Rosary will follow starting at 10 a.m. and Mass of Christian Burial will follow at 10:30 a.m. all at Christ the King Catholic Church, 5711 Southwest 9th Street. Nick will be laid to rest at Glendale Cemetery. The family respectfully requests that all guests wear masks and practice social distancing. For those who would like to honor Nick in lieu of flowers and gifts, are encouraged to donate in his name to the Des Moines Fire Department Honor Guard at Des Moines Fire Department, 1330 Mulberry Street, Des Moines, Iowa, 50903. A special thank you to Carrie, RN, Sam, Mia, and Autumn at Methodist Hospital, who took exceptional care of Nick and his wife, Clara Lee, during this difficult time. Mary Jane Jones. Mary was born on February 27, 1927, in Des Moines, to Robert and Addie Bruce, and passed away on January 18th. Mary served as a deaconess at Philadelphia Seventh-day Adventist. She will be remembered most as a loving mother and grandmother. She is survived by her brothers, William Bruce, Richard Bruce, sister Beverly Jackson, and a host of grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Mary was preceded in death by her parents and her children, Jeffrey Jones, Ralph Jones, Pamela Richardson, David Jones, Janine Brown, Von Seal, Hannah, and Larry Jones. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. with funeral services to begin at 11 a.m. on January 30th at True Bible Baptist Church, 4101 Amherst Street, Des Moines, with burial to be at Glendale Cemetery. John Avery Geddes took rest from his earthly labors and entered the presence of his Savior January 24th. Second-born son to Ronald and Sarah, maiden named Leonard Geddes, John grew up on the family farm in Farrar, where he learned to love the work of tending the land, cultivated an interest in raising cattle, and developed friendships with his 2 brothers and other classmates, which lasted a lifetime. Graduating from Farrar High School in 1947, John spent the next few years on the western slope of Colorado as a ranch hand before joining the U.S. Marine Corps in 1951. It was with great pride that John served his country through his time in the U.S. Marine Corps. While serving in the Korean War, John was severely wounded and required extensive medical treatment. For his courageous service, honors and military awards were given to him, including the Purple Heart and Bronze Star. John married Ellen Crabtree, June 6th of 1954, in Pope Joy, Iowa, and they were blessed with three daughters. Together with his family, John made his home a few miles south of Farrar and cultivated a small farm he called Happy Hollow. Besides cattle, John had a great interest in forestry, and this hobby can still be seen on the family farm. These two interests, cattle and trees, led to a hobby of how to keep them separate and safe from one another. John's handiwork of building fences around trees can still be seen in multiple places around the farm. As a young man, John put his faith in Christ for salvation from his sins, and being an active member of church was an important part of the remainder of his life. After Ellen's passing in 1998, John moved to Gunnison, Colorado, and married Anita Leonard. The last few years of John's life were spent back on and around Happy Hollow, where he enjoyed reading biographies, tending his small garden, and keeping an eye on the cattle herd. Friends and family will gather to remember John's life at a funeral service at Altoona Regular Baptist Church on February 1st at 1 p.m. The family will greet friends from 12 noon until service time on Monday at the church. A Facebook Live broadcast will begin at 1 p.m. on the Pence Reese Funeral Home and Cremation Services Facebook page. A graveside service in Farrar will take place immediately after. Funeral arrangements are being handled by Pence Reese Funeral Home of Newton. John is preceded in death by his wife Ellen, daughter Lois Elizabeth, parents Ronald and Sarah, and brother Clark. Those left to remember John's legacy include brother Ronald, or James, Geddes, spouse Marlene, daughters Mary Gossuk, spouse Sam, of Togiak, Alaska, Kay Matson, spouse Larry, of Farrar, Carolyn Frey, spouse Gary, of Foz do Iguaça, Parana, Brazil, grandchildren Laura Jacobs, spouse Peter, Julia Little, spouse TJ, Krista Robinson, spouse Josh, Hannah Prudencio, spouse Leandro, Jonathan Frey, spouse Aaron, Ellen Weech, spouse Donovan, Adam Matson, spouse Olivia, Luke Frey, spouse Kara, Nathan Gosuk, Samuel Frey, 15 grandchildren, and several nieces and nephews. James Fenner Jones, known as Jim, age 75, of Granger, died Monday, January 25th. Jim was born May 11, 1945, in Des Moines, son of Glenn and Josephine, maiden name Mitchell, Jones. He married Barbara Bass of Johnston on April 2, 1967, in Des Moines. Jim graduated from Ankeny High School in 1963. He worked for Meredith Printing, later R.R. Donnelly, in Des Moines and Pontiac, Illinois. He was drafted into the Army in 1965, and served in Korea before settling in Carlisle to raise three children with Barb. Survived by his wife, Barbara Jones, two sons, Stephen Jones, spouse Shelley of Fairfax Station, Virginia, and Adam Jones, spouse Maggie of Ankeny, four grandchildren, Noah, Eva, Maximilian, and Josephine Jones, siblings, David Jones, spouse Kathy of Johnston, Geraldine Remster, spouse Dick of Adel, and Sherry Shearer, spouse Larry of Madrid. Preceded in death by a daughter, Jennifer Jones, two brothers, Harry and Stephen Jones, and two sisters, Shirley, Harvey, and Josephine Robertson. Visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. Sunday, January 31st, at Peterson Funeral Home in Carlisle. Interment will follow in the Carlisle Cemetery. Masks are required. Social distancing is encouraged. www.petersonfuneralservice.com. Leonard Lee O'Hare, age 83, of Waukee, entered Heaven's Gates on Monday, January 25th, at Independence Village in Waukee. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Monday, February 1st, with visitation from 10 a.m. until service time at McLaren's. Burial will be at Walnut Township Cemetery in Waukee. Please join the live stream at www.mclarensresthavenchapel.com. Leonard was born May 12, 1937, and shared his birthday with his identical twin brother, Edward. He was the son of Lester and Ida Ruth, maiden name Leek, O'Hare, and was born and raised in Centerville. Leonard graduated from Centerville High School and earned a business degree at the University of Iowa. He worked at National Travelers Life, American Mutual, and Employers Modern Life companies. Leonard was a member of the Masons, the Scottish Rite, and the Zagazig Shrine, and plays his trumpet in the bands. He was always willing and proud to play taps for the World War I veterans when they met annually in Des Moines. Leonard is survived by his wife Linda, sons Greg O'Hare, spouse Melissa, of Westfield, Indiana, and Jeff O'Hare, spouse Laura, of Kansas City, Missouri. Stepdaughters, Lori Billings, spouse Brian, of Urbandale, and Kathy Myers, spouse Mark, of Des Moines. Brother, Edward O'Hare, of Indianola. Mother of his sons, Beverly Dyson, spouse Doug, of Kearney, Missouri. Grandchildren, Benjamin, Alexandria, Annabelle, Anderson, Mitchell, Ethan, Emily, Taylor, Jacob, Nick, Braden, Josh, and Danny. He was preceded in death by both parents, sister Patricia Crow, and brother-in-law Leo Crow, sister-in-law Janet O'Hare, along with his beloved golden retrievers, Alfie and Jake. The family wants to thank everyone at Independence Village in Waukee and Suncrest Hospice for their loving care. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to Waukee Christian Church, of which Leonard was a member, or the American Parkinson Disease Association, APDA, Iowa Chapter, P.O. Box 643, Ankeny, Iowa, 50020. That concludes the obituaries for today. I'll turn now to the sports page of the Register. We have some late Wednesday results for the Drake women's basketball. The headline, Bulldogs make it 10 of 11 versus UNI. And this is a special to the Register. The Drake women's basketball team bounced back from two straight road losses, beating Northern Iowa 96-78 at the Knapp Center on Tuesday night. The Bulldogs played strong first-half defense, shot 56.3% for the game, and got a lift from the return of senior guard Maddie Monahan in beating UNI for the 10th time in the last 11 meetings. Grace Berg led Drake with 21 points, while Kiara Collier added 17 points on 6-for-8 shooting, including 3-for-4 from the three-point range. Freshman Courtney Becker made all three of her three-point shots and scored a career-high 13 points. With 6-foot-3 Maggie Baer sidelined by an injury, Maya Mertz played 15 valuable minutes in the post. She made all four of her shots in scoring 8 points. Monahan, who had missed the three previous games because of an injury, made her first shot, a three-pointer from the left wing, and finished with 8 points, helping the Bulldogs square their season record at 8-8 and improve to 6-3 in the Missouri Valley Conference. Cynthia Wolf led the Panthers, who are 8-8 overall, 5-4 in the MVC, with 18 points. Freshman Maya McDermott of Johnston scored 15, and Megan Moss had 12. The Bulldogs held UNI's leading scorer, Carly Rucker, to 2 points on 1-for-7 shooting. Drake, which dropped a pair of games at Missouri State on January 22nd and 23rd, returns to action at Loyola on February 5th and 6th. Alongside that, we have Drake men's late Wednesday results, with the headline, Hempel powers Drake men to 15th win in a row. Shaquan Hempel had a career-high 24 points as the Drake men's basketball team won its 15th consecutive game to start the season, defeating Missouri State 78-73 on Wednesday night. Roman Penn had 18 points for Drake, or 15-0 overall, 6-0 in the Missouri Valley Conference. DJ Wilkins added 11 points. Tramell Murphy had 10. Drake defeated Missouri State 68-61 on Tuesday. Coming off a 3-week layoff to come down here and get 2 wins is huge for us, Drake head coach Darian DeVries said in a university news release. A day after rallying from a 17-point deficit to win, Drake built up a 13-point lead Wednesday and then held off a 15-0 Missouri State run to prevail. Hempel finished with 10 of 15 shooting as one of 4 Bulldogs in double figures. Penn had a big second half, and Wilkins had a pair of critical 3-pointers in the final minutes. Tank Hempel was really aggressive in the first half and was able to get downhill and get to the rim, DeVries said. He played 40 minutes, and it was an awesome effort for him. Isaiah Mosley had 23 points and 11 rebounds for the Bears, who are 9-3 overall, 5-3 in the conference. Gage Prim added 20 points and 14 rebounds. Keaton Hervey had 10 points. We put them on the free throw line too much, and we have to learn to stay aggressive without fouling, DeVries said. We held Prim for a good chunk of the game and made his finishes tough. Mosley had a nice stretch and was a big part of their comeback, but to finish the game, the defense really carried us. Drake took a 13-point lead early in the second half and kept the lead at double digits for much of the half, until the 11-17 mark, when MSU began its 15-0 run to take its first lead of the game at 63-61 with 6 minutes remaining. I looked at our group and said, "This is what you're built for," DeVries said. Their experience and leadership coming down the stretch was going to be what determined the outcome of this game. I thought they settled down and were able to make some big-time plays to finish the game. The Bulldogs host Illinois State on Sunday at 2:30 p.m. and Monday at 6 p.m. A limited number of fans will be allowed inside the Knapp Center for the 2 contests. For more information on ticketing and attendance policies, visit draketix.com. And at the bottom of the page is Mark Emmert's article about tonight's game for Iowa. Garza Hawkeyes eager to tangle with Illinois again. There are no post-game handshake lines in college basketball this winter, a tradition the COVID-19 pandemic has made unthinkable. Then again, Iowa and Illinois didn't need the excuse of a coronavirus to avoid such generic of sportsmanship. These teams just aren't interested in pretending 40 minutes of bare-knuckle basketball can be wiped clean by a fist bump and a nod. "They want to kill us. We want to kill them," Illinois star guard A.O. Dosunmu said after a 78-76 victory against Iowa last March. Hawkeye guard Joe Toussaint was reminded of that sentiment Wednesday and quickly concurred, noting that it's not personal. "I don't really like anybody, if I'm being honest with you. That's just how it is in basketball," Toussaint said. The last time the Hawkeyes and Illini met on the basketball court was March 8, 2020, the same day the first 3 cases of the novel coronavirus were reported in Iowa. The teams were on course to play again a week later in the Big Ten tournament, but that event was wiped out minutes before the Hawkeyes were due to leave their Indianapolis hotel for their first game. So was the NCAA tournament. That meant Iowa's season ended with that narrow loss in Champaign, Illinois, leaving the Hawkeyes with 10 months and 3 weeks to wait for a chance to avenge it. That finally arrives at 8 p.m. Friday today, once again at State Farm Arena, but minus 15,544 roaring fans. Advantage Iowa, in quotes. The most anticipated Hawkeye game of this regular season will be broadcast on FS1. It is the only scheduled meeting between number 7 Iowa, 12-3 overall, 6-2 in the Big Ten, and number 22 Illinois, 10-5 overall, 6-3 in the conference. A fact that left both fan bases grumbling and even drew the attention of Hawkeye star center Luka Garza. When your season ends, you always think about the last game because it's the last imprint on your mind, said Garza, who scored 28 points in the final contest of his All-American season, but couldn't connect on the basket that would have forced overtime. "It was a tough one, and obviously it coming down to the last shot and me not being able to get a good shot off. It definitely is something that sticks in your head, you know? What could I have done better?" As for only getting one shot at the Illini in his senior year, Garza said, you always want to play the best in your conference twice, especially in the Big Ten race. You want to be able to beat them as many times as you can. In order to beat Illinois even once, the Hawkeyes must be able to withstand a beating. That's what they did in the first meeting a year ago in Carver Hawkeye Arena, making key plays down the stretch for a 72-65 victory, punctuated by a Joe Weiskamp dunk and harsh words in the handshake line. A month later in Champaign, the Illini jumped the Hawks, building a 16-point lead while knocking Weiskamp and guard C.J. Frederick off stride. Frederick objected to one instance in which he felt he was being manhandled and drew a technical foul. Meanwhile, Iowa guard Connor McCaffrey and Illinois counterpart DeMonte Williams glared at each other for a few uncomfortable seconds while the referees sorted that out. That image relays everything about the intensity and even the animosity that has come to define this rivalry. The first thing to watch Friday will be how tightly the game is officiated. If physical play is allowed, things could quickly turn chippy. If not, a star player or two could be forced to the bench with foul trouble. Frederick's status for this game, one he would dearly love to play in after being held to 3 points in 31 minutes in the last meeting, is in doubt. He has an unspecified injury to his ankle or foot and missed the bulk of Iowa's 81-69 loss to Indiana on January 21st. If Frederick can't play, Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey has a couple of primary options. One is to move his son, Connor, from power forward to shooting guard and to start either Keegan Murray or Jack Nunge in the front court. Connor McCaffrey, who had 10 points and 8 assists in the game last March, is versatile enough to handle that, but he's not the outside shooting threat that Frederick is. I'll have to adjust on who I'm guarding and maybe a little more aggressive here and there, he said, because if CJ's out, we lost another offensive weapon. It's also possible that Fran McCaffrey will take a look at a lineup that inserts Toussaint at the point and moves Jordan Bohannon to the shooting guard spot. Bohannon, who missed both of last year's meetings with Illinois after hip surgery, is the most prolific three-point shooter in Hawkeye history. Toussaint showed last year that he can thrive while playing against a team intent on trying to intimidate. He scored 14 points in 19 minutes in the loss to Illinois, even making a pair of three-pointers. But he is happy to leave the long-range shooting to Bohannon, if that's what is called for. When he gets hot, I just keep looking for him, Toussaint said. Obviously, I'm really fast. I can get anybody the ball. One more note. Bohannon is coming off an 0-for-8 shooting performance from the three-point arc against Indiana. The only other time he even approached that level of futility was an 0-for-6 showing at Michigan State as a freshman. The next game? Iowa played Illinois. Bohannon was 3-for-4 from distance. Those are some intriguing subplots in a game between the two teams picked to finish atop the Big Ten this winter. But the primary storyline will surround the stars who opted to forego pro careers to take one more shot at a title and each other. Garza leads the nation in scoring at 26.9 points per game. Dosun Mu is averaging 21.7, second in the Big Ten. Illinois center Kofi Cockburn at a sturdy 7 foot, 285 pounds, is shooting 70.1% from the field and scoring 17.4 points per game. He leads the Big Ten with 10.3 rebounds on average. It was Cockburn who deflected Garza's last second shot the last time these teams met. Garza, a perfectionist, was replaying that moment in his mind immediately afterward and likely many moments since. He didn't want to appear overly eager for one game of 27 on Iowa's schedule, but you could tell in Wednesday's interviews that this matchup means more to him. And it should. We know that we have to focus and be able to go out there and execute our game plan in a building that's hard to play in and against one of the best teams in the country. If you're not motivated for this game, I think there's something wrong with you, Garza said. I want to play against the best. I don't dodge anybody. I was excited when Cockburn and Dosunmu came back. It's good for our league." End quote. It's good for anyone who values spirited competition. These teams, these players, will give fans a show to relish Friday. The life section is pretty short on articles today, so I'm going to go ahead and read another sports piece. This is Randy Peterson's column, and the title is Iowa State Men's Hoops Roster is Limited Again. The good news, Iowa State will have more players in the bench area and in uniform for Saturday's Big 12 SEC Challenge. The bad news, the roster still is probably limited. And now for the uncertain news about Saturday's game at Mississippi State, who's 9-8. Who Steve Prohm actually plays in this made-for-TV event wasn't exactly known when reporters had a video conference with the coach Thursday. It'll probably be more than the seven who contributed in Monday's 81-60 loss at home against Oklahoma State. But how many more is as uncertain as when this 2-8 team's four-game losing streak finally ends. "Our guys are doing well," said Prohm, who had just six healthy scholarship players and two walk-ons available for the Oklahoma State game. "I don't know how much will change. We could have one more guy back, possibly. Whether they play or not, I'm not sure." Jalen Coleman-Lanz and Solomon Young were at the Sukup practice facility shooting before practice Thursday. But really, all that means is that they're out of COVID-19 protocol and they're eager to get back into games. Both were regulars. Both were desperately missed last Monday, but they haven't played since January 9th against Texas Tech. They haven't played in 20 days, which is an eternity in college basketball when you're running full throttle back and forth on the court. The good news, those Cyclones will likely make the trip to Starkville, Mississippi. The bad news, they might not play, or if they do, it probably will be just a few minutes at a time. "We'll have more guys on the trip for sure," Prohm said. "It's their ability to play that's not for certain for sure, but we will have more guys on the bench." Staying with this good news, bad news theme, any player the Cyclones, who are 2-8, get back playing will be a welcomed addition to a team that hasn't won a Big 12 game since defeating TCU on February 25th of 2020. Last Monday, for example, George Condit was the only Iowa State available player that was taller than 6'6". The bad news with that is that he's foul prone. Therefore, Prohm will take as much from a healthy Young as he can get, whenever it happens. "There's a process you have to go through," Prohm said. "Make sure everybody checks all the boxes. Make sure they're sound. Make sure they're physically ready to play. You don't just jump right back into things. It's a process of getting them back. Good news, it'll slowly happen over the next week or so again, albeit gradually." Prohm had just eight players available for full practice early Wednesday. Patience is a must for this season. It's a huge must while doing a job in which you get paid handsomely to coach winning games. "I've wondered in print, on radio, and in podcasts why this annual event is even happening this week. Forget the fact that it's played during the conference season, which isn't exactly the greatest timing from a coaching standpoint. COVID-19 has forced postponement of games, and although many have been rescheduled, some still haven't. Iowa State, for example, has games against Kansas State and Texas Tech still pending. What would have been wrong with using the date reserved for the challenge as a makeup Saturday? Silly me. It's wall-to-wall Saturday exposure on ESPN. That's what's wrong with my thinking. The SEC challenge is great for our league, regardless of the pandemic," Prohm said. "There's a lot of things with TV. A full Saturday of straight Big 12 SEC. It's great for our league to have a day where it's just about the Big 12. It's great if you're a team with a full roster. Is it so great for a team that might just play six scholarship players for the second game in a row? It's great where these young guys can take advantage of these next couple games," Prohm said, "of the extended minute opportunities that newcomers are getting right now. Hopefully, as we go into the second half of conference play, we can be deeper, we can have more experience, and we can put ourselves in position to finish the right way. I'm using it as a positive, end quote. And now I will turn to the life section of the Register, where the feature article is titled, Why Finding Ohana is More Than Just a Hawaiian Goonies. And this is a movie review written by Lauren Saria. In a little side note here, the movie is rated PG for language, crude references, adventure action, and some suggestive comments. And the author gives it a reviewer star rating of 4 out of 5 stars. Here is the review. It would be easy to write off Finding Ohana as a Goonies redux that just happens to swap the misty Oregon coast for the stunning landscape of the Hawaiian Islands. But the visibility the film offers for the complexity and beauty of Hawaiian culture makes it so much more. The movie, which streams on January 29th, is a part of Netflix's Representation Matters collection. It tells the story of Pili, played by Kia Pohu, and Ione, played by Alex Aono, who are Brooklyn-raised siblings who end up spending the summer in Oahu. Their mother, Hana, played by native Hawaiian actress and Kamehameha School's graduate Lindsay Watson, brings them back after her father falls ill. She moved the family away from the islands after her husband's death 6 years prior and doesn't seem to have been back since. There's tension between Hana and her dad, Kimo, that's only intensified when she discovers financial missteps have left him at risk of losing the family's property and home. Suddenly, the trip could turn into a permanent stay. There are worse fates, for certain, than feeling forced into relocating to paradise. But there's a sharp nugget of truth behind the anger Hana feels when she discovers she may have to sell her New York apartment to meet her kuleana, or responsibility, to her family. But this is an adventure flick, so Pili, short for Pili Aloha, or Beloved in Olelo, Hawaii, discovers a journal that sets her on a hunt for long-lost treasure. Not only does it present an opportunity for fun, by the way, she's an accomplished geocacher and therefore uniquely prepared to take this on, but it also provides hope she can find enough money to save her grandfather's home without having to uproot her own life back east. Or at least that's what she thinks. At the bottom of the page is another movie review with perhaps a different conclusion of a different movie. This is written by Bill Gutekunst, and the title, Even Denzel Washington Can't Make the Little Things Great. And this movie is rated R for violent / disturbing images, language, and full nudity. It does get a star rating of 3.5 out of 5. With a ton of talent and 4 Oscars between them, you'd expect big things from Denzel Washington, Rami Malek, and Jared Leto teaming up for a movie. What you get instead is The Little Things, which is both the title of writer and director John Lee Hancock's crime thriller and a pretty apt description of it, too. It's a good movie. It is not a great movie. The film, in theaters and streaming on HBO Max on January 29th, is set in 1990 and begins in California, where Joe, or Deacon, played by Washington, a sheriff's deputy, patrols a sleepy area. His boss calls him in and orders him to L.A. to pick up evidence from the crime lab. Deke doesn't want to go, but he has to. When he shows up at the homicide division of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, Deke is greeted like a leper. We learn bit by bit that Deke was a detective there and left under controversial circumstances. He says hi to the captain in a scene that would keep your beer cold, so frosty are the relations between them. What happened here? Deke wanders past a media briefing where Jim Baxter, played by Malik, a sergeant in homicide, is holding court, obviously enjoying himself. Baxter is trying to explain the department's inability to catch a serial killer. As one reporter puts it, 4 dead women, 2 months, no suspects. Baxter only knows Deke by vague rumor, but when the evidence for Deke's case is delayed, he asks him to tag along on the investigation of the latest murder. Deke, it seems, also has a reputation as a meticulous detective, legendary for picking up on details. You know, the little things. Deke and Baxter quickly zero in on Albert Sparma, a creepy guy with a rather creepy name, played with understated but powerful creepiness by Leto, who excels at this kind of role. The film's strongest scene occurs in an interview room, where he strings Baxter along. Baxter calls in Deke, and Sparma gets to even him. It's a riveting back-and-forth exchange. At this point, Malik is mostly watching, but Washington and Leto have at it brilliantly, culminating in 2 words from Sparma, in parentheses, not those 2 words, that are perfectly delivered by Leto that devastate Deke. The film could have used more powerhouse scenes like that. The only other article in the Life section is a repeat from yesterday. It was the Carol Murphy Marcos article entitled Step Away from Your Media Feed and Detox that we read from the USA Today yesterday. So I will be moving on to the USA Today now. I'll start with the short pieces from the Moneyline column. Brewer to make history as CEO of Walgreens. Walgreens has tapped Starbucks executive Roz Brewer as its new CEO, which will make her the only Black woman leading a Fortune 500 company. Starbucks announced Tuesday that Brewer was departing after a little more than 3 years as its chief operating officer. Later, Walgreens confirmed that Brewer will take over as its CEO on March 15th. Brewer succeeds Stefano Pessina, who was CEO for 6 years. Grape Nuts fans are feeling the crunch. A COVID-19-related shortage has Grape Nuts faithful missing that familiar crunch of their favorite breakfast cereal. The brand, which is owned by Post Holdings, confirmed the shortage to USA Today on Wednesday, but said there were absolutely no plans to discontinue Grape Nuts cereal. People may continue to see shortages and temporary out-of-stocks on Grape Nuts as we continue to work through supply constraints and higher cereal demand amid the pandemic, Kristen DeRock, Grape Nuts brand manager, said. WhatsApp adds layer of biometric security. WhatsApp users with biometric authentication on their phones will now have added security. The Facebook-owned platform announced on Twitter that the new feature requiring a user's face and fingerprints to link devices were to roll out Thursday. The messaging app currently has more than 2 billion users. Once a user tries to access their WhatsApp account on the web or desktop app, they will be required to verify their identity using the face or fingerprint unlock on their phone. They then will still have to scan a QR code with their phones. From the Life section, here is one of the short stories from the Lifeline column. This is the Tweet Talk segment, where Mel Brooks is the star's sound off on Twitter subject. Such sad news. Cloris was insanely talented. She could make you laugh or cry at the drop of a hat. Always such a pleasure to have on set. Every time I hear a horse whinny, I will forever think of Cloris's unforgettable Frau Blucher. She is irreplaceable and will be greatly missed. That was Mel Brooks tweeting Wednesday night of Cloris Leachman, whom he directed in the 1974 classic Young Frankenstein. Leachman, best known for her role as Phyllis Lindstrom on the 1970s sitcoms The Mary Tyler Moore Show and its spinoff Phyllis, died Wednesday at the age of 94. And then for another notable death, I'll read Andrea Mendel's article, Trailblazing Actress and Icon Dies at 96. This is about Cicely Tyson. Royal, legendary, a queen. Those are the adjectives often invoked at the mention of Cicely Tyson's name. the actress and cherished icon who was first Oscar nominated for 1972's Sounder, and 45 years later was honored with an honorary Golden Statuette for her body of work, died Thursday at age 96. Her manager, Larry Thompson, confirms to USA Today. With heavy heart, the family of Miss Cicely Tyson announces her peaceful transition this afternoon. At this time, please allow the family their privacy, Thompson said in a statement. Tyson's death comes the same week her memoir, Just As I Am, was released. I have managed Miss Tyson's career for over 40 years, and each year was a privilege and a blessing, Thompson's statement read. Cicely thought of her new memoir as a Christmas tree decorated with all the ornaments of her personal and professional life. Today, she placed the last ornament, a star, on top of the tree. End quote. Through Tyson, Black women were represented roundly and robustly over seven decades on screens big and small. She trailblazed roles portraying the lives of women ranging from fictional slave-turned-activist Jane Pittman and educator Marva Collins to activist Coretta Scott King and abolitionist Harriet Tubman. Still, it's difficult to convey just how deeply the actress permeated American culture through the decades. Tyson helped bring Roots to life in 1977 as Binta, Kunta Kinte's mother. She stole the show in 1991's Fried Green Tomatoes, gave weight to 2011's The Help, and grounded modern TV series such as House of Cards and How to Get Away with Murder. The actress won three Emmys and a Tony Award, and was awarded a Kennedy Center Honors in 2015. African Americans hold Cicely in such high regard, she is a queen to us, said Tyler Perry in 2018. She would only do roles that served us. The actress was born in Harlem, New York in 1924 to a carpenter father and a domestic worker mother, both of whom immigrated from the West Indies. After finishing high school, she began as a secretary for the American Red Cross before deciding to try and become a model. By the late 1950s, Tyson was flourishing in the industry, covering magazines like Essence and Jet. She notoriously went against her mother's advice when she decided to become an actress. Tyson was kicked out of her mother's home, and the two didn't speak for 2 years. Tyson began on stage in New York, eventually working her way into television by way of small roles on shows like I Spy, Naked City, The Bill Cosby Show, and Nurses. Her film career was a slower burn, as Tyson actively avoided blaxploitation films popular in the late 60s and early 70s. As her opportunities grew, so did her insistence on staying true to the women she portrayed. Tyson was adamant that she wear her hair natural and based on the role she was playing, launching a natural hair craze. After sporting short hair as Secretary Jane Foster in East Side, West Side, I got letters from hairdressers all over the country telling me I was affecting their business because their clients were having their hair cut off so they could wear it like the girl on television, she told Oprah Winfrey. Then came Sounder. The film dealt with the economic and personal strain shouldered by Black sharecroppers in Depression-era Louisiana. Playing the family's complicated matriarch, Rebecca Morgan, Tyson's performance garnered her an Oscar nomination for Best Actress, though the prize went to Liza Minnelli for Cabaret. 2 years later, Tyson made history as the first Black woman to win a Best Lead Actress Emmy for Jane Pittman, one of the first television projects to depict the fraught reality of the African-American experience in the Deep South during the transition out of enslavement. Tyson was ultimately nominated for 16 Emmys, winning a third Emmy for her supporting role in the 1984 miniseries Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. She remained one of the most prolific actresses of the last century, working steadily through her 80s and 90s. In 2013, after 3 decades away from the stage, Tyson starred in the Broadway production of The Trip to Bountiful, a project based on a 1953 Horton Foote play about a homesick, elderly woman itching to return to her rural Texas hometown. Tyson had seen the original 1985 Bountiful film, which starred Geraldine Page, in a theater. I went straight to my agent's office and I said to him, "You get me my trip to Bountiful and I will retire," the actress recalled in an episode of Oprah's Masterclass. "I said, I just want one more great role and then I'm finished. I won't be greedy. I'll just step out of the picture." He looked at me and chuckled. Almost a quarter century later, Foote's daughter approached Tyson about adapting the film for Broadway with an all-black cast. The film adaptation of Bountiful earned Page an Oscar in 1986, and 26 years later, the project spawned similar magic for Tyson, who took home her first Tony Award at age 88 for the play. Her performance captivated. Audiences were known to sing along with the actress when, mid-play, she launched into the hymn, "Blessed Assurance." A year later, Tyson would resume her lead role in the TV film adaptation for Lifetime, which she executive produced. In 2015, she returned to Broadway in The Gin Game, opposite James Earl Jones. In 2018, at the age of 93, she was still going strong, filming episodes of How to Get Away with Murder as Viola Davis's mother. For Davis, as a child, watching Tyson on her TV screen in Jane Pittman changed my life, end quote. "To see someone who resembled me achieving great things, Miss Tyson gave me permission to dream," she said, while toasting Tyson at the Kennedy Center Honors. But Tyson kept her more intimate details close to the vest, rarely discussing her love life, including her relationship with jazz legend Miles Davis. The two began dating in 1966 and were married for 7 years, from 1981 to 88. Tyson, who is often credited with helping the trumpeter recover from alcohol addiction, called theirs a tumultuous relationship. "You have two people who are so enriched, blessed by incredible talents. I thought he was. He thought I was. And what it takes to live from day to day with that," she told CNN's Don Lemon in 2013. "There are so many facets to a dual life that is completely alien to most people. There have been some of the most incredible moments in my life afforded me through him." Tyson was a longtime patron of the arts, and in 2016, President Barack Obama awarded her with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, recalling how the actress famously declared she, quote, "would not accept roles unless they projected us, particularly women, in a realistic light and dealt with us as human beings," end quote. Obama added, "Cicely's convictions and grace have helped for us to see the dignity of every single beautiful memory of the American family." Receiving her honorary Oscar in 2018 in Los Angeles, an emotional Tyson brought the house down while brandishing the golden statue on stage. "Mom, I know you didn't want me to do this," she said, "but I did, and here it is." In the final pages of her memoir, Tyson reflected on how she hoped to be remembered. "Here in my twilight years, as my Christmas tree towers and glistens, folks are always asking me what legacy I want to leave, what roots beneath my soil I most hope will outlive me. I want to go home knowing that I love generously, even if imperfectly. I want to feel as if I embodied our humanity so fully that it made us laugh and weep, that it reminded us of our shared frailties. I want to be recalled as one who squared my shoulders in the service of Black women, as one who made us walk taller and envision greater for ourselves. I want to know that I did the very best that I could with what God gave me, just as I am." And with that, it's time to turn to Dear Abby. Her column today has the headline, "Dad Questions How to Handle Ex's Disinterest in Their Son." Dear Abby, "My ex-wife, my son's mother, moved out a few years back and settled about 6 hours from us. We did halfway trips in the beginning so they could maintain a relationship, and I have even driven the whole way a few times to help with that. Over the last 2 years, her interest has diminished, and they haven't seen each other at all. I've offered the halfway trip, even offered my couch if she came the entire way, especially around holidays. She hasn't taken me up on it. Our son is now entering his teens, and I bought him a cell phone. She has his number, but doesn't call or text. She even missed his birthday. My problem is he has started to recognize her lack of interest, and I can tell it hurts. I thought about changing his number and cutting her off altogether, like yanking off a bandage, but I don't know what's best. Please advise. Signed, Sane Dad in Maryland. Abby says, Dear Dad, you are a loving and constant father. As you have realized, now that your son is getting older, he is becoming increasingly aware of his mother's emotional neglect. I do not think you should change his number and cut her off from him. She's doing a good job of doing that herself. I do think it's important your son knows he can talk to you about anything and get honest answers. Something is clearly wrong with his mother. He should not go through life thinking her behavior was caused by anything lacking in himself. So if and when the subject comes up, answer his questions as kindly as you can. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Friday, January 29th, 2021. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa, 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon each day. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart is read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with the schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.